I want to take just a few minutes to introduce our speaker tonight. He's Pastor Tom Kracht. Am I saying that? The Dutch word is Kracht, but yeah, you want all that? Ugh? Okay. All right, Tom Kracht. And he's the pastor at Evergreen Church, been there for about 15 years. He's been in the ministry a total of 32, and spent some time working with Spectrum Health. Did some schooling at Spring Arbor, and seminary at Western, which many of us refer to as the Hope Seminary because it's over that way. He's got three married children, five grandchildren, the oldest one 8, and the youngest one 1. Yeah, yeah? Okay, super. And they all give him lots of encouragement. Some of you might recognize him because he does basketball officiating, so you might have seen him on the court. If you say, "Yeah, where have I seen this guy before?" And he's going to share his story tonight. And previously, as well as being at Evergreen, he's been at Hager Park and Lafayette, Indiana, at some Reformed Church down there. So he's going to talk about spiritual care for alcoholics and those who love them. And so I think he said he's doing something like this again tomorrow morning. Yes, so he gets asked to do these sort of things. Next week, just a quick plug, Josh Vendrunen from Zutphen. And we have some other representation from Zutphen tonight in the back. And his topic will be 1,000 sermons and counting. And by my math, if you're in the business of preaching, and that's your career, I think that takes about 10 years or so to get to that point. And so we'll have that next week. So without any further ado, if you'll help me welcome Pastor Tom, I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, good. Thank you. Thank you. Let's have a prayer together and we'll get started. God, thank you for this beautiful day and the great meal that we had, for your love for us and for the many ways that we get to do ministry as the people of God. Be with us tonight as we talk about an important topic, and help us understand encouragement and help. In Jesus' name, amen. Hey, you guys can come forward if you want. I don't bite. I really don't. So, like to make this, do you have my PowerPoint up by any chance?
Not yet.
Is it good? All right. I'll just talk a little bit more until he's got that up. I'm a recovering alcoholic. Okay? My last drink was April 15, 2000, tax day. So I didn't want to give any more money to the government, and I needed to stop drinking on that day. So I've been sober about a little over 18 years by God's grace. And for 3 years, I needed to take some time off of ministry in my early recovery, and I did that, and I got a job working at Spectrum Health in a treatment center for them. And I did that for about 2.5 to 3 years, and that was one of the, I thought it was like a timeout, kind of, from quote-unquote real ministry, and that ended up being one of the most valuable experiences I've ever had in terms of training me for ministry as well. So it's like getting another graduate degree. You would say. So I've been a pastor in Lafayette. We had First Reformed, Community Reformed, and then there was Lafayette Christian Reformed Church. I think there's a Sunrise Christian Reformed Church now in Lafayette, if I'm not mistaken, but we were known as the three Reformed churches in town. People, you know, down there aren't very many of us, so to speak, if I can use some insider language there. And so it was good. A guy named Bryce Mensick was the pastor at the Lafayette CRC. And Bryce and I remain good friends to this very day. And it was a long time ago that I left there in 1990 to come to Michigan. So anyway, it's good to be with you. And I think this is a topic I love to talk about. I think that, you know, if you're here tonight, maybe there's someone that you care about that needs help, and I'd be happy to talk with you about that after the session if you'd like to chat with me. Or maybe you need help, and that's awesome if you do. It's very hard to ask for help, but it's a very important thing because it's something that we can't figure this out by ourselves. We need help. We need God's help, and we need people's help to do this. I went to treatment in Chicago, and the director of our program was a guy by the name of Dr. Marty Dute, who has been on the board many times for Trinity Christian College in Chicago, And Marty was an elder in the CRC, and he had given his whole life to addiction medicine. Okay, and he was really one of the top addiction doctors in the country. Marty died of a heart attack a couple years ago at 61. And so that was a big loss. But if you were a physician and you got in trouble in Chicago with drugs and alcohol, Marty was the guy you had to see and go through to get your license squared away and all that sort of stuff. But he's a wonderful guy, and I always remember my experience with him. And he was a parishioner of, I don't know if you've ever remember the name, Alex DeYoung. Alex was, a prominent CRC pastor and theologian who was also in recovery. And Marty was in Alex's church when Alex had to go into treatment. And so, in fact, they've written a book, Dying for a Drink, that's published by our publishing company, our church's publishing company, that you can buy. And it's a great read, and I would encourage you to get it. It kind of tells their story of Alex having to go into treatment, and then Marty, Dr. Duke, talks about, you know, alcoholism and so forth. So it was good to get to know him. But Marty said, Dr. Duke said, the reason that he gave his life to addiction medicine is he had this aunt who was one of the most godly people he knew. Taught Sunday school forever. And she couldn't stop drinking. She couldn't stop drinking. And that really had a huge impact on him. And so as he went to medical school and his training, he pursued a specialty in addiction medicine, and that's why he gave his career to that. So we need guys like that. How are we doing with the PowerPoint?
He'll be here in about 2 minutes.
2 minutes. All right. So, yeah. Shoot. Let's see. I'm trying to think of any. Well, we'll be ready to go in just a minute. You know, it says substance abuse is like the second or third most expensive health problem in our nation. Multiple billions of dollars every year. It costs our culture and society. By the time you add up medical bills and court costs and lost wages at work and losses of finances to employers, and everything, it's just astronomical what substance abuse addiction costs. So it really is a big issue. And I think this is also an area where we have an opportunity, I think, as Christians to make a difference and to really reach out to people who need a lot of help. And they got to be willing to get help. But I think it's, for us, you know, at Evergreen, I do recovery ministry at Evergreen. And it's been fun to be involved in that and get to meet a lot of people that aren't very close to God. And it's been really great to see some people get well and some don't. Some people die and some don't. And but it's an exciting thing to be involved in. So hopefully we'll get this going here a second, and then I can have some more direction to my talk tonight. I get 10 extra minutes. Okay. All right. Now, is this a gizmo I can...
Yes.
Okay. You guys have such a vibrant atmosphere on Wednesday night. This is really great. Yes, sir. It's horrible. It's just horrible. You know, I do think there are some legitimate medicinal purposes that should be prescribed by a normal physician, not a hack someplace that's just trying to give excuses to drug addicts to get a marijuana card. But it's just, it's really sad. And it's going to create more difficulties, more addiction. Marijuana is highly addictive in and of itself. The marijuana industry has a lot of propaganda out there that will tell you it's not and all of that, but it is highly addictive, and especially it's a gateway drug for a lot of folks. as well. So I really am not in favor of legalizing marijuana. I wouldn't. I would like to see the, you know, the, there was a gal at our church a few years back that was dying of glioblastoma. And her physician told her if she could get some marijuana, she should smoke it. And she did. And she said to me, "Pastor Tom, I was going to ask you how to get hooked up because of all the people you know." And I'm glad she didn't. So anyway, but she and she got a lot of relief from the pain that she was in for that. And so as far as you know, cannabis itself maybe having some pain release value, I think more and more there is that, but it should be medically supervised. And I don't think anybody should self-prescribe when it comes to pain medication. That's just not a good idea. That's what we have doctors for. You know, because that's when we can really get in trouble with that stuff. So, all right, we're here. Rev Talks. Hey, good deal. So the green has got to be the goal, I would think. Okay. Is the ball going? All right. And, of course, you know, we've got the marijuana issue, but we really have a huge opiate crisis in our whole nation right now. We have a lot of young people dying, and a lot of people dying, not just young people. And so that seems to be the big crisis right now is with opiates. And that's why you're seeing all kinds of new laws about it. So anyway, there's me, and what we're going to be talking about tonight, providing spiritual care for alcoholics and those who love them. So the first part of my presentation, I want to talk primarily about alcoholism and addiction, what it is, and maybe field some questions about that. If you have questions as we're going along, feel free to raise your hand, okay, because just like you did, I would like to have some conversation this evening. And then if we have time toward the end, I've got a, on the end of it, I've got 10 signs of dysfunctional helping, okay? And that would be more for the people that are trying to help addicted people. So let's get going here. Hey, there we go. What is it? What are we talking about, okay? Alcoholism and drug dependency is an addictive disease in which the sufferer is physically and or psychologically dependent on alcohol or drugs. Because of the addictive nature of alcohol or drugs, the addict loses control over his or her drinking behavior. Now we're going to fill that in a little bit more. And we're going to talk a little bit more about what I mean by a disease. Because some people would say, well, that lets the alcoholic off the hook or the drug addict off the hook if you call it that. Why do we call it a disease? So I think I like to label it a spiritual disease, okay? Because to me, my alcoholism has really connected for me our spirituality and our creation and our fall. Okay, because I don't think there'd be alcoholism if we hadn't fallen. Okay, I think it's one of those things that's a result of the fall. And yet, the primary answer to recovery is spiritual in nature. So here you have a physical malady, and the primary recovery is spiritual in nature. So why do we call it addiction, alcoholism, a disease? Because, first of all, there are three criteria by which you call a disease as a disease. It's chronic, it's progressive, and it's fatal. Okay? It's chronic, it's progressive, and it's fatal. Now, let's go back to the beginning there. You see the word primary. And this is really crucial, I think, when you're talking about addiction and alcoholism, is to see it, I like to say it, as a primary disease. By that I mean it's the main thing in and of itself. Sometimes people will come to me on behalf of a loved one and they'll say, well, if his job wasn't or her job wasn't so stressful, they wouldn't drink so much. Or if their kids would behave better, they wouldn't drink so much. Or if, you know, the sun would come up shining every day, they wouldn't drink so much. And so what that does is that it makes excuses for the problem, okay? But alcoholism and addiction is something that stands alone in and of itself, and I don't think it is created. I mean, things can contribute to it, but in and of itself, it isn't created by those things, okay? Someone doesn't, it's not stress usually that makes an alcoholic. It's not alcohol. Believe me, alcoholism makes stress. Okay? I thought I had all kinds of stress too. And it was amazing when I stopped drinking how all the stress went away. All right? So really we're helping feed denial when we say there are other things that if they would just fix the marriage or if they would just fix the job or get a new location. Some people think if they move from Grand Rapids to Denver that they'll be fixed. Well, we have an old saying, wherever you go, there you are. All right? You know, there's no such thing as geographical fixes when it comes to this stuff. You have to fix the person. The person needs to be fixed. So it's a primary thing, and that's really important, I think, for someone who is sick to an alcoholic needs to understand that, because the alcoholic in their denial wants to blame everything but the problem, okay? So it's marked by impaired control, sick spirituality, broken relationships, preoccupation with the drug, alcohol is a drug, adverse consequences, and denial, okay? And denial. So again, if you have any questions, please let me know, okay? Let's keep moving then. Alcohol and drugs become a major focus for the person's behavior and thinking. The person loses the ability to make sober choices over the use of their drug of choice. With this loss of freedom to choose, alcohol dependency or drug dependency develops into a life-threatening addiction. Okay, the AA Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says there's only three things that can happen to you if you continue to drink. It'd be jails, institutions, or death. And we have massive denial in our culture about how much death alcoholism causes. Finally, we're starting to see some obituaries, and I really give the families credit. In the Grand Rapids Press, if you ever read obituaries, there's some beautiful stories about people that just couldn't get sober, how they tried and tried. So instead of covering it up, okay, the family was honest and said that several of us in this family have this illness. Several of us have gotten sober. Some of us haven't. And Joe or Sally passed away as a result of their drinking. Boy, that takes guts, doesn't it? But we need more cultural honesty about this. You didn't die. You know, maybe someone died of cancer, but the cancer wasn't discovered because there wasn't appropriate self-care, because they were too drunk all the time to do self-care, all right? And a lot of other things can come into play, but where death occurs, and really the culprit is alcoholism. I remember a former parishioner, her sister was drinking herself to death, and she was in the hospital on her last leg, and she asked me to come up to the hospital to be with her. And so she went in to see her sister. Her sister passed away, and the doctor made the comment her kidneys failed. And she came out and said to me, and she said, I'm glad alcoholism didn't kill my sister. Okay? See, family members have denial too, don't they? Family members have denial too. I mean, it's really tough for you to admit your sibling is an alcoholic, or your parent is an alcoholic, or your child is an alcoholic. And in this arena, we just can't afford to play games, because life and death is at stake. And we have to be 100% truthful, because this disease will kill us otherwise. All right? And so we need more family honesty. And really, if you could really go through, honestly look at the number of people that pass away because of an addiction that was in their life, I think you'd be shocked at how much that kind of stuff can play in their lives. Okay, now, you know, one of the things that we talk about is that once you're an alcoholic, you're always an alcoholic. So I'm in recovery, I'm a recovering alcoholic. I have to be abstinent. okay? I can't drink. I'm just as much an alcoholic today as I was in 2000 when I quit drinking. All right? I'm no less of an alcoholic. And so if I would start to drink again, it would be disastrous for me to do that. We have a kind of a corny little saying in AA, I don't have alcoholism, I have alcoholism. Okay? And that's why I sit at a 12-step meeting and I say, my name's Tom, I'm an alcoholic. Because I still am. My alcoholism's in remission. And as long as I don't drink one day at a time, that's fine. But once you have this thing, it doesn't go away. You know, we don't know of anybody that was an alcoholic and returned to normal drinking. That creature doesn't exist. Okay? I've never met anybody in our recovery meetings where they've gone back out and quote-unquote tested the waters and come back and say, hey, it was great out there. It worked out this time. I learned how to drink successfully. No one ever does that. I remember when I was working for Spectrum, had a gentleman came in. He was a retired farmer from Lowell. He'd done very well for himself. He was single now. His wife had passed away several years ago, and he was retired. He'd been sober. He hadn't had a drink of alcohol for 27 years. And he was on a plane coming back from Europe, and he decided he could have a beer. A month later, he's in treatment. He's drinking two cases or a case and a half a day. Okay? And he couldn't stop. Okay, now that tells you something's different in his mind, isn't it? Something's different inside of him, the way he reacts to alcohol. I know that, and so one of the things, you know, in the 1930s when AA was founded, they didn't have the scientific terminology that we have now. But what they said in the AA Big Book is they called alcoholism an allergy. They said, we believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomena of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These alcoholic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And that's pretty much where the medical community is today as well, is we've got to be abstinent if we're in recovery from mood-altering drugs and chemicals. And so that's kind of a core thing. We'll talk more about how we get that message across in a few minutes. So any questions on that? So it's primary. It's this thing I'll have until I get to go to heaven, be with Jesus. Okay? It's not going to go away. Now think about this. All right, if there wasn't some kind of biological component, let me digress just a bit. I had my first drink when I was 16 years old, and I thought I discovered the meaning of life. Okay, I absolutely loved to drink. It made me feel so good. And I could tell that when I drank with my friends, I looked forward to drinking more than they did. Right from the very beginning. I couldn't see it then, and I couldn't see it till I'd been sober for a while. I couldn't see it then, but I don't think my thinking from the first drink has ever been healthy about alcohol. Okay, when it's Tuesday and you're thinking about, you can't wait till Friday night because you're going to go out to eat with some friends and you can have some drinks, that's not normal. Today is Wednesday, and I'm not thinking about right now what I'm going to drink on Friday night, are you? Something's wrong if you are, okay? So that is the mind of an alcoholic, is our perspective on alcohol is really kind of wrong. And so that tells me from my first drink, I think I had a propensity, something internal, biological even. And that's not excusing it. I'll talk about that later. Think about this. If alcoholism was just a sin and there wasn't any kind of medical component to, it seems like once you get sober, you should be able to drink again. Reasonably. Okay? If there wasn't any kind of a medical component, if it was just strictly a sin spiritual issue, man, I haven't had a drink for 18 years. I should be able to have a beer now without it, with impunity. No, it's not the case. Okay, there's something that I have inside of me that if you're not an alcoholic here tonight, you don't have, thankfully. You guys, and we're not against drinking. I'm not against drinking. If you can, you know, wine's a gift from God, we see in the Bible. And so this is not, we're not on a crusade to for temperance or anything like that, okay? But for those of us that have this thing, is we need to be abstinent. It's really important because our lives depend on it. So anyway, let's keep rolling. Okay, what causes alcoholism? I think that there are three or four things that kind of come into play that can cause it. I think there's a genetic factor. We see a lot of time alcoholism is in families. You've seen that too, I'm sure. You know, I think there's psychological, social, and spiritual issues that maybe there's been some trauma in a person's early life that has contributed to their susceptibility to this. Trauma is a big factor, okay? And then also exposure to the drug itself. I mean, if you never drank, you wouldn't become an alcoholic, right? So it's and I think it's when, and with, I think for various people, there are various, either one of those things will be stronger than the other. You know what I'm saying? You know, I think there'll be someone who's got just a strong genetic disposition to it, and they're gone. There'll be other folks that over time, some things have really gone wrong for them. And through drinking, and it happens to them. And all of a sudden they wake up and they're in trouble with alcohol. So I think those are some of the causes of alcoholism. So it's part of the brokenness of our humanity. Okay, I think there are a couple different types of alcoholics that we run into. First of all, there's a type one. Develops typically later in life, 30s, 40s, 50s, maybe older even. And a number of factors could be contributing causes, just like we said. All right? Then we've got another type two. It's passed on only from father to son. Symptoms begin in early teens. I mean, I've worked with some young men that are 17 years old. They can drink a fifth and a half and not even think about it. I don't know if you've ever had a shot of whiskey or not, but that is a tremendous amount of alcohol, okay? And for some reason, they have tremendous tolerance. Tolerance is not a blessing. If you have low tolerance to alcohol, thank God. You know, if you have one drink and you go, wow, I don't want any more of that, you know, be grateful for that, okay? Tolerance is not a blessing. When it comes to this, but these young kids that we see, that they come in and they can just drink massive amounts of alcohol, and they get in trouble, big trouble with their health, and a lot of times legal, school, other stuff, right away with it. But typically, it's from father to son, and there are exceptions to every rule, but that's kind of the pattern that we often see with people. Okay, what are some warning signs and symptoms that someone is developing a problem with drugs and alcohol? I think drinking for the effect of the chemical itself. Purposefully using the drug alone to feel better. We have had a horrible board meeting at church tonight. I have to go home and have a couple beers before I go to bed. That's not healthy. How about talk to God about it? Right? You know, or I had a very stressful week at work, and I need to drink to feel better. And the thing about it is, the Lord has given us, you know, Paul says, "Don't be drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit." And the Lord has given us, with His Spirit, and naturally, He's given us capacity to resist stress, to be able to endure underneath stress and the difficulties of life, and. The more that we give ourselves to alcohol as a remedy for the stress, the more alcohol strips us of the God-given capacity to deal with life. Understand what I'm saying? The more we give ourselves to drugs and alcohol, the more we lose the capacity to deal with life. And so the alcoholic is convinced that their friend is alcohol. And in reality, alcohol stripping them the capacity that gives them to live life is what it's doing. It's the great subtractor. All right? And so everything seems overwhelming. And the most frightening, terrifying thought to an alcoholic is never to be able to drink again. That's horrifying to an alcoholic. To tell me I can't ever drink again. That is just horrifying because they can't live without it. They're convinced of it. And that's a lie, obviously, but that's part of the disease here. Another sign is amnesia and blackouts. I don't think normal drinkers have blackouts. I think if probably you left here tonight and you got a little tipsy, you'd probably remember everything you did. An alcoholic will have a blackout. So I tell young people, especially, one thing is when young people come in and they're drinking too much, I ask them, do you ever have blackouts? By that, I don't mean a whole night's wiped out. You can't remember where you put your car keys. You can't even remember where you parked. You maybe can't remember how you got home. Well, yeah, I have those. That's a warning sign, okay? That's a warning sign, because most normal drinkers don't have those things. So that's a one indicator, okay? There's, of course, the preoccupation with alcohol and drugs. You have the sneaking of drinks and using of drugs. You show me an alcoholic, and I'll show you an accomplished liar. It's what we have to do, because our drinking becomes unacceptable to people in the amounts that we drink. Okay, so we have to become people of deception. And then, of course, gulping first drinks or drugs to get the effects as rapidly as possible. Maybe not eating dinner for 2 hours so I can drink and have the full effect of the alcohol so food doesn't absorb it and doesn't affect my buzz. Okay? Those are all very unhealthy kinds of things that I think are symptoms, possible symptoms, that a person could be in trouble with alcohol or drugs. Any questions? Keep going here. Signs and symptoms continued. Loss of control. Increased tolerance, needing more to get the same effect. Family employment and legal problems occur. Again, the alcoholic thinks the family employment and legal problems are the cause of their drinking, but it's the drinking that's causing the problems. Okay? As part of the denial, we have to break through. Continued use in spite of harmful consequences. And then denial kind of surrounds it all. Now, one of the things, I'm going to say something that will really surprise you, is in the course of our alcoholism, the heart and the mind become dysfunctional, I'll think of another word for it, but your whole way of thinking and viewing life becomes corrupted by the drugs and the alcohol. So that, I would say that the alcoholism, probably only 10 or 15% of alcoholism is the state of inebriation. Okay? I think only 10 to 15%, maybe 20% of alcoholism is the state of inebriation. The rest of it is the way the mind and the heart, what the mind and heart is becoming as a result of the drinking. Okay? So it's just not a matter of ingesting a drug and, well, now I drank yesterday so I was bad, and I didn't drink today so I'm good. Okay? But an alcoholic adopts an alcoholic way of thinking and viewing life and responding to life. Okay? Have you ever heard the phrase, he or she's a dry drunk? What? They've stopped drinking, but they're still an idiot, right? I think that's what the original Greek says, all right? You know, they're just a jerk, all right? And that's because they haven't entered into recovery. Recovery, we're going to talk about it. Recovery is more than abstinence, okay? Recovery is more than abstinence. I'll talk about that in a little bit. So comprehend that the state of alcoholism, just a small percentage of it, I think, is really the state of inebriation. It is a destruction that it does to you the rest of your life, okay? While you're drinking. Denial and self-decision, deception. The alcoholic, an addict, loses control over drinking and using. Denial begins to fuel the disease of addiction. The alcoholic and the addict rarely sees him or herself as the source of the problem. A 5-year-old can see very clearly what an alcoholic can't see. They blame other people or circumstances or problems caused by the addiction. Problems then become the reason using is imperative. Family members are very often in denial of the problem as well. Okay? We call it a family disease. The damage that's done, I don't think there is anything in our human experience as destructive as alcoholism. Yes. Because I've a pastor and I've been with people as they're dying of cancer or other related diseases, and they're very close to Jesus. Okay? The Lord's very near to them, and they're experiencing a lot of grace. An alcoholic death is godless. It's empty. It's alone. It's isolated. I mean, alcohol takes everything, and then it comes calling for you. Okay? I mean, there is nothing like an alcoholic death in the totality of its destruction. Spirituality, relationships, mental and physical destruction, families, employment, social and legal. I mean, it's exactly like the sign of the picture of the hurricane there. Okay? It just affects everything. And it's thorough and complete in the damage that it does. So, we've talked about the sickness. How do you get well? How do you get well, okay? That's the good news. You can get well from this thing, okay? I think, first of all, it starts, especially if a person's been drinking heavily, they may need to be medically detoxed. That a detox from alcoholism is the most dangerous detox there is. It can kill you. Okay, if you're physically addicted to alcohol, you need to be medically detoxed. Not every alcoholic is physically addicted to alcohol. All right, but a person that is needs to be medically supervised. And so I would recommend seeing a doctor that's one of the certifications. It's American Society of Addiction Medicine certified. ASAM is the name. I think therapy can play a key role, and I think you need to see a counselor with a specialty in addiction. There are a lot of good counselors out there, but there are a lot of good counselors that don't know anything about addiction. And so I think that's really important, is if you're going to get some help or your loved one's going to get some help, but you want to see a counselor that has had some experience working with addiction, okay? And then 12-step communities, and then the God connection. And some caution is needed there, and I will talk about that in a few minutes. Now, I talked a minute ago about the destruction. You saw the destruction there of what alcoholism does to a person. And you'd look at that mess, and you wouldn't just say, okay, the tornado came, the tornado's gone, everything's good now. You couldn't possibly say that, could you? Well, it's the same thing with alcoholism and addiction. Abstinence isn't enough. Okay? So the goal of recovery is not abstinence. The person needs to be healed spiritually. They need to be healed emotionally, relationally, physically. All of those things are crucial for that person to be rebuilt, all right? And so that's one of the things that the 12-step movement is all about. You know, in 12-step meetings, we talk very little about alcohol. It's mostly about our spirituality, and we talk about honesty and resentments and anger and love and forgiveness and all those kind of core spiritual issues in a very honest and intense way that have all really become bad under the influence of alcohol. And so the 12 steps are about rebuilding. That's why we call it recovery, okay? It's not just about abstinence. Recovery is about repairing the damage that's been done. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with the 12 steps. The first step says that we're powerless over alcohol. The second step says that we came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. The third step says we surrendered. Fourth step, we took a moral inventory. The fifth step is we shared it with God and with another human being. And then the seventh step, we pray about our character defects. In the eighth step, we made a list of all the persons we'd harmed. In the ninth step, we made direct amends to such people. We tell people in early recovery, the steps are in order for a reason. You know, when you first get sober, people are tired of your sorries. Yes, sir. I think, let me finish the steps, and I'm going to go right after your question, okay? That's a great question. The question is what about the people that don't have any faith? It must be really difficult for them. And that's true, but let me explain, okay? Let me get through the rest of it. So 8 and 9, we made our amends. In the 10th step, we continue to take personal inventory. When we're wrong, promptly admitted it, because we don't need junk hanging out there. And the 11th step, we improve our conscious contact with God and our prayer time and all that stuff. And the 12th step was we carry the message. Every church ought to be a 12-step church. I mean, as Christians, we ought to be about carrying the message too, right? I mean, actually, the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous were Christians, and I think the 12 steps are really a great kernel of New Testament spirituality. And so they end missionally, all right? Now, back to your question is... I think that just a kernel of faith, even if it's temporarily the group, is a start. Let me explain. What often happens, I said caution when I said God. Let's go back a couple of slides here. Thought I said caution. Did I pass it? All right. Next one. All right, thank you. Caution needed. My alcoholism is not only hurt my relationships, is my alcoholism has screwed up my capacity to think about God in healthy ways. And one of the pitfalls for Christians in early recovery is they want to stop at the third step. Well, I've made a decision to surrender to Jesus, and so I'm all fixed. And Jesus, all the Jesus talk, then kind of becomes a way for me not to take responsibility for my behavior. Understand what I'm saying or not? Because if you're an alcoholic, you've got behavior you've got to take responsibility for. And yeah, Jesus does save you by grace. Absolutely, he does. But you still have behaviors and internal things that are warped and sick that you need to deal with. And I find often in early recovery, people that want to go gung-ho toward God they're still very sick in their thinking, and they're using God more as a defense mechanism to keep them from dealing with their own real issues. If I can just keep all the God stuff out front, then I can just stay superficial and talking about myself. That's why we have a saying, 1, 2, 3, drink. Because, the third step, the third step is a step where you made a decision to surrender to God. Well, that's all you've done is make a decision. The big book says at the end of the third step, unless this step is followed immediately by a rigorous moral inventory, it will have no permanent or lasting value. And so the founders of AA realize you need to really work this program. And so that's where I say it's been my experience, I have more hope for the guy or gal that comes in and doesn't believe or is angry at God, or they have a resentment at the church, real or imagined. I have more hope for those guys than I do the guy that comes in and starting thumping Jesus right away. It seems sad, doesn't it? But it's true. And that's because the alcoholic is often, I believe God can zap people sober in terms of take away the desire to drink instantly. But recovery, think about this now. Recovery is sanctification. Okay, when we're talking about those 12 steps, recovery is sanctification. Justification is what? It's that legal act on the cross. Jesus died for your sins and my sins, and God raised him from the dead, and we accept that by faith, and we're declared righteous. Right? Instantly, when faith comes. However, if we're honest Christians, we know sanctification is a struggle. Sanctification is the process of becoming more godly. We can resonate with what Paul says in Romans 7. The thing I do want to do, I don't do, right? The thing I don't want to do, I do. And so recovery is, in that sense, I wouldn't say this to new alcoholics I'm working with, because the last thing they need to be thinking about is theology. But it is really, recovery really is sanctification. So to take a person that's just dry is like being satisfied with a Christian that's just justified and never goes to church again, in that sense, okay? So that's why, that's my answer to your question. So I, ultimately, yes, they're going to have to come to grips with God. Ultimately, yes. But at first, I'm not too worried about it, because I've seen what God does if people just will open the door a crack, what the Holy Spirit will do in terms of reaching out to people. Is that helpful, sir? Yeah. So any other questions on that? So that, Mark.
So I don't want to give you the free right to say I'm not touching this, okay?
Okay.
Drinking is in front and center in the news with the Kavanaugh hearing.
Right.
And I'm not asking you about politics or anything.
Right. I know a lot of young people that were partiers in college and drank heavily and grew out of it. Okay? My best friend is an attorney in Grand Rapids. When we were young men, we got hammered together a lot. Guess what? He has a bottle of whiskey in his house that's been there for 15 years. And I want to go, what's wrong with him? Okay? So I... just because the nominee used to party a lot and party hard doesn't mean he's unfit to be a pastor now. Okay, you know, so that's how I would answer that. But if he was doing that now, yeah, I'd have some real concerns about it, you know. So I think a lot of kids do some partying and stuff like that when they're younger, but if you're not an alcoholic, you grow out of it. My friends grew out of it, I didn't. Okay? And so that's why you need to be careful. Great question. No politics involved. Okay? Yep. At all there. So the spiritual growth side of it is really important. And, you know, I needed to be, you know, when I went down, I felt spiritually just flayed like a fish. Is the only way I can describe it. And I really needed a time to heal. Okay, and to really have the damage that I did to myself and the relationships that I hurt, I needed time to heal that. And the 12 steps for me were such a gift from the Lord to be able to do that. I know when I did my, you know, people will report different kinds of spiritual experiences going through the steps. I know when I did steps 8 and 9, I made my list of amends, and I made my amends, and you do that under the direction of a sponsor and all that stuff. But I think that was the most powerful spiritual experience I've ever had in my life, was doing my 9th step in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was in the process of doing that step that God took the desire to drink out of my head. It was gone after that. I mean, I was sober before that. It was hard. But once I got to that point in the steps, man, it was gone. And so there, there is the spirituality of the steps with the Lord's help is really, really important. Like I said, it's basic Christian sanctification, I think, stuff that we're doing. And another thing I'd like to say, we want people, especially when they come in, they want everything fast. You know, they've been drinking for 20 years and they want to get better in a week, right? It doesn't happen, man. Okay? And so it takes time. It's 20 miles in and 20 miles out. But the 12th step, I wish I had the steps up here. I'm sorry that I don't. But the 12th step says this. It says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. In all of us alcoholics, we want the spiritual awakening on the front end of the steps so we don't have to do any more work. The 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we carried the message to alcoholics and to others who were suffering. So it's the process of working through those steps that God heals us. You know, so the 12 steps aren't just hocus pocus. I mean, it is a spiritual program of recovery that we really take very, very seriously. And you can just see the difference. And it's amazing to see the miracles we see. I mean, you see, you know, like Legion in the Bible. All of a sudden, the guy's sitting there in his right mind. And it's just such a beautiful thing to see and to be a part of. Just awesome, yeah. You know, people come in, right, I think, I like to say, you're a sick person. You show me an alcoholic and I'll show you somebody that hates themselves. You don't have to tell an alcoholic they're a bad person, they know it. They know it through every fiber of their being. And I remember one of the definitions that we give to alcoholism is self-centeredness run riot. You show me an alcoholic, I'll show you the most self-centered person in the world. All they think about is me. Me, 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 me. All the time. You've seen it if you know one. All right? So I was, you know, it was interesting to me. I was told, I was in the gutter just like everybody else in terms of how I felt about myself and all that stuff. And I went to a meeting out in Cascade, and met my sponsor, who was a retired FBI agent from New York City, Catholic guy. And he came up to me, and he could see I was not doing well in terms of emotionally. And he said, Tommy, he says, don't worry if you can't love yourself. Let us love you until you can. And I think that, I thought, wow. I must be at the right place. You know, I never had anybody say that to me before. Okay? Let us love you until you can. And so what happens then is, I kind of call it the Philippians road of the steps too, is that the alcoholic's ego is massive in self-centeredness, and their self-esteem is in the gutter. And so every single step of the 12th step is designed to crush the ego. Every step. AA is no place to hang on to your ego. Admitted I was powerless. My life's unmanageable. Believed God could restore me to sanity. Surrendered my life to God. Took a moral inventory. Shared it with God and another human being. On and on and on. So every step is a step down. And it was amazing to me how, as I was going this, you know, working my way down the steps, so to speak, how my sense of self was beginning to rise. Appropriate self-love. I mean, it's a miracle. And I thought of it really, the journey makes me think of Philippians 2. You know, have this mind in you, which is yours in Christ Jesus, right? Who, though he was in the form of God, didn't count equality with God something to be held on to, but he emptied himself, right? Taking the form of a servant, he humbled himself and became obedient to death. Okay? And so that's what the steps do. That's the road of the steps for those of us that need to be in recovery, is that self-centeredness needs to get smaller. Humility quotient needs to grow. And that's the spirituality of recovery. And that's what repairs us. That's what makes us productive citizens again. That's what makes us pastors again, factory workers again, college professors and physicians again. Because this illness is no respecter of status of society or how smart you are. In fact, the smartest, I've also found general, I hate generalizations, but I think it's the smarter guys that have a more difficult time getting sober because of the ego. And so that that's been a powerful journey spiritually, and so I liken it to the journey through the steps is I think a great parallel for our Philippians profession of faith about Jesus, as Paul wrote there in Philippians 2, and we need to keep doing that. Okay, you know, people will ask me, why do you go to meetings? Are you afraid you're going to drink? I'm not afraid I'm going to drink tonight. Okay, but I go to meetings because I like the honesty at the meetings. People don't hide behind anything. Nobody comes there and pretends. I mean, people say the most incredible things about themselves. It's unbelievable. And everybody thanks them for coming, you know? And it's just a beautiful thing. A very, very important part of my walk with God is part of the 12-step community. So I might get thirsty again if I stop going. You know, it's been our experience too. You stop going to meetings, eventually you're going to pick up again, probably. You pick up again, you're in big trouble. Let's keep moving, unless you got a question, okay? Yes, sir.
At what point do you call them an alcoholic?
I don't know. You know,
it's so hard to say.
It's so hard to say, isn't it? Because consumption for alcoholics is all over the map. You know, you know, and this is not a minimization for me. My tolerance level was not great compared to some of my friends in AA, but that doesn't make me any less of an alcoholic. Okay, some people have a higher tolerance. You know, I think it's what it does to you. Or you know, or and then if you're, and it, are you abusing it? Okay. You know, maybe, I mean, a lot of people will overuse alcohol. Just because someone abuses alcohol doesn't mean they're an alcoholic. There's a difference between alcohol abuse and alcoholism. And so not everybody that gets a DUI is an alcoholic. Although, it's getting close, I think, you know. But, you know, when and where do you cross that line where... it becomes really a need, and you're depending on it. Instead of the Lord, you're depending on it. And when you're depending on it, then it starts to rot you, spiritually and emotionally. Yeah. I think drugs and alcohol cut off our conscious contact with God. Again, that's why I think Paul says in Ephesians, don't be drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit, because they're polar opposites of each other. Okay? You know, and so we have folks, and I know folks of all over the map on that consumption issue. You know, so if you're not an alcoholic, enjoy the beverage. I don't have any. There's no big deal about it. Seriously, we're good Calvinists here. We weren't raised on chocolate milk, okay? You know, all right. You know, so I'm not here to preach against any. You know, I'm serious. Enjoy a beer, all right? And I don't expect. Another thing is when I go out for dinner with people, I don't expect them to not have a drink just because I'm there. Okay, you see, if I can't handle you having a drink, then I shouldn't be there. But you shouldn't have to change your behavior because I'm there. Okay? Because you're not, you know what? You're not responsible for the alcoholic, right, Mom? You're not responsible for the alcoholic's recovery. If your drinking is going to make me drink, then I'm responsible not to be with you. It's not your responsibility not to drink. Okay?
Well, some people can handle a lot, some can't live.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, in early recovery, I didn't go to hardly anything that served alcohol anywhere. All right? I can do that now. I've been sober a little longer. I'm a little more on my feet now. You know, I can go to a wedding, or I can go to a sports bar and have dinner with my wife. And I'm there, and it's not a big deal. But I think in early recovery, people need to be really careful. You know, when I got sober, I turned my social calendar over to my sponsor. Sponsor is kind of the recovery name for someone who's discipling another person. And I think you need to have that kind of a commitment to it. Because an alcoholic is remember I told you, they're not thinking like an alcoholic only when they're inebriated. It's the whole thing. You know, and so in early recovery, we're capable of making really poor decisions about who we hang out with, where we go, how we're thinking, taking jobs, quitting jobs, or whatever. And so you really need help. You really need a lot of help. And so one of the things I did is I just gave my social calendar to my sponsor. I said, tell me what's up here. Can I go here, whatever. So the first wedding I did, after I was sober, the reception was wet, like most are. And I talked to my sponsor about it. He said, all right, here's our plan. He said, you're going to call me before you go. You're going to drive yourself. You're going to call me while you're there. And then on your way home, you're going to call me. And guess what? I didn't drink. Okay? You know what? You got to be willing to do that kind of thing, though, I think, early on. Or you get yourself in trouble. Okay? So that's, whoever asked that question, that's a good question. But anyway, I just wanted to say that you guys, you are not responsible for my sobriety. I am. That's one of the biggest tricks an alcoholic likes to do is make you responsible for my sobriety. See, if you were a little more considerate, wouldn't drink in front of me, I can go drink. You're a bad guy. I'm going to stop at the party store and drink. That's how alcoholics think. Make someone else responsible for my recovery, then I'm off the hook. Give me another excuse to drink. So no, I'm responsible. Tom's responsible, not you. Make sense? Yeah? If you're going to have alcohol to function, it's up to me whether or not I want to come. All right? Another important, and I'll wrap it up here in a minute. Another really important key to this is this one day at a time thing. Didn't Jesus say something about let today's trouble be enough, right, for today? Is, you know, I know in my head I can't ever drink again. Okay, but I'm not going to make that commitment to you. I intend to not drink again, but what I will commit to you is for the next 24 hours I won't drink. And so tonight when I get home, I'm going to thank the Lord I didn't drink today. And when I get up tomorrow, I'm going to ask him to help me stay sober tomorrow. And so, because we can get so caught up into the forever of this whole thing, it's overwhelming to people. And so we really need to live one day at a time with our sobriety. All I need to do as an alcoholic today is not drink today. God is not asking me to stay sober tomorrow. Yet. Okay? He's not asking me to stay sober at Halloween yet, or Thanksgiving yet, or Christmas yet. I worry about those days when they get here. Right now, October 3, 2018, it's the only day God cares about me not drinking right now. Okay? And then tomorrow, I'll do it again. And that's the way it works for us. Works pretty good. So, you guys have been great. Thank you. One or two more questions if you have any. Yeah. Yes, yes. Oh, man, that's a whole thing we didn't talk about tonight. Family members get as sick as the alcoholic does. You don't understand it. I don't expect you to. Sometimes sicker. And family members need help. Al-Anon is a great program. It's the other side of the other side of AA. It's a 12-step program for family members. And one of the things that I gave you information on is at Evergreen on Thursday nights. It's free. You can come whenever you want. I teach a family and friends class every Thursday night at 7. And it's for people who are either friends or have a family member that has a problem with drugs or alcohol. That they can come and we do some education, we do some support stuff, because there's a lot of stuff out there for the alcoholic and the addict to get help, but there's very little for family members who have been banging their head against the wall and going crazy. that really do need help and support as well. So thank you. Yes, sir. Well, we talk about codependency, enabling. We have the Al-Anon has three C's that you need to live by. You didn't cause it. You can't control it. And you can't cure it. That's a big deal. And that's frightening. If you love an alcoholic, that's frightening to you. So I tell you what, if you love an alcoholic, you cannot fix your alcoholic. I'm telling you that right now. There is nothing you can do. There's some healthy things you can do to make the environment better, but you can't fix your alcoholic. That's got to be God's work. So quit playing God and get out of the way and let God do his thing. That's scary though, isn't it? Yeah. So we talk about detachment, okay? Detach with love, not detach and kick out and detach and hate. But how you can emotionally kind of detach and not be affected if the alcoholic, you know, if you have to live with the behaviors sometime. So a lot of things like that. Drawing, what are good boundaries to have? Maybe a family needs to draw a contract with a kid if he's going to stay home. Okay, what's that look like? Those kinds of topics we talk about, family and friends. So you are more than welcome to come to that. Every Thursday night at 7, come and be with us. So thank you, everybody. I appreciate it.